The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, and welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind listener mail. My name is Joe McCormick. My regular co-host, Robert Lamb, is out today, so I'm going to be recording this episode solo. But don't worry, Rob will be back on mic with me next time. It's Monday, the day of each week that we read back messages from the Stuff to Blow Your Mind email address. If you would like to get in touch, you can write us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com. Whatever you want to send is fine. We appreciate feedback to recent episodes, especially if you have something interesting to add to something we have talked about. Okay, I'm going to start off today with a response to an older series of episodes we did on throwing behavior in non-human animals. And one of the big examples we talked about in that series was a paper about octopuses doing something that looked like deliberate targeted throwing of inanimate objects like shells and clumps of sediment at each other, and I think occasionally at fish, but mostly at each other for getting in one another's personal space. And I do recall there was some ambiguity about whether that was the right interpretation of the behavior or not. Was it actually targeted throwing or just something that kind of looked that way because they were kicking up dust or sediment for some other reason? And continuing the theme of octopuses and animal throwing, Nathan writes, "Hi, Robert, Joe, and Carney." Ah, shout out to the mailbot. "I just finished listening to your episodes on animals throwing things when I saw an interesting article on the CBC. There had been video caught of a sea lion and octopus fighting off the coast of Nanaimo, British Columbia, which is definitely not typical octopus stomping grounds. In the video, the sea lion picks up the octopus and throws it across the surface of the water with surprising force at least twice. In the article, Andrew Trites, director of the Marine Mammal Research Unit at the University of British Columbia, says that sea lions will bite down hard on one tentacle, then fling the octopus in an effort to tear the arm off. This is apparently the safest way for them to prey on octopus, as otherwise the octopus can suffocate the sea lion with its many tentacles. Thanks for all your great work, and though behind currently, my wife Olivia and I never miss an episode. Thanks, Nathan." Well, Nathan, thank you for sending this in. So I went and looked up the CBC article you referenced. It's from November 17th, 2023 by Andrew Kurjata. If you want to look this up, folks, it is called "Swimmer Witnesses Surprise Fight Between Octopus and Sea Lion." And the video is attached with the article. The video is pretty cool. So you can see this marine mammal repeatedly breaching the water surface, seeming to kind of gasp and struggle at something. And then a couple of times, it does suddenly whip its head around and fling something from its jaws. And it looks to me like immediately after it does that, especially in at least one instance, but maybe in a couple of them, the sea lion is working its jaws, maybe like it's chewing on something. And according to this researcher that Nathan mentioned, Andrew Trites, who is the marine biologist quoted in the article, the sea lion in the video was a steller sea lion. And that's a species name spelled S-T-E-L-L-E-R. One of the two species found in these waters, along with the California sea lion. I'll read a direct quote from Trites explaining this behavior in the article. Quote, "The challenge for a sea lion is to swallow an octopus without the octopus using its eight arms to grab onto the sea lion's head while it is being swallowed whole. The sea lion would suffocate. The sea lion's solution is to bite down onto one arm at a time and fling the octopus's body with all its force to rip off an arm to swallow whole. They do it at the surface because they can get more torque in the air than they can underwater." I missed that detail about him swallowing the octopus arm whole, so maybe it's not chewing. I don't know. The jaw working could be something else. But anyway, this would explain why the sea lion was poking its head up above the water to do this, that it's trying to get more torque when it flings its, whips its neck around to throw the octopus and try to rip the arm off. Another consideration mentioned in the CBC article is that the octopus not only threatens to suffocate the sea lion that is preying on it, it can also wrap itself around a predatory mammal's head like a sort of killer monster mask and bite with its beak. Also worth considering that octopuses are venomous. So yeah, it makes sense that the sea lion is really eager to get the octopus away from its face even while trying to eat part of the octopus's body. Now, this behavior brings me back to an issue we talked about in that series on animal throwing behavior, which was the cognitive distinction between throwing behavior that seems to be for the purpose of affecting the projectile versus throwing that's designed to affect the target. So, for example, throwing a nut against a rock to crack the nut versus throwing a rock at a target animal to make it, to hurt the animal or to make it go away and leave you alone. There is implicitly different cognition involved. In one case, you already have the object you want to affect in your possession, and you throw it in order to change something about it, maybe to damage it or just to get it away from you, to change its location. In the other case, the target you want to influence is at a distance from your body, and the projectile is a third-party tool you're using to cause that effect at distance. In this case, I think it's pretty clear that the throwing is to affect the projectile, not a target. And it's in two ways. The goal is, number one, to rip part of the octopus's body off so that it can be eaten, but then also just to get the other arms and the beak away from the sea lion's face. So anyway, many thanks, Nathan. Okay, on to another message leading to some interesting facts about animal behavior. So Troy wrote to us in response to a previous listener mail after our Weird House Cinema episode on critters. Critters is a mainline Gremlins movie series about little monster hedgehogs from space that love to eat. The movie we covered was the original film from 1986, but a previous listener brought up the fact that in the sequel from 1988, which is Critters 2, The Main Course, the Krites at one point glom onto one another to form a gigantic ball that rolls around smashing people and generating mayhem. And the question came up whether there are real world examples of animals that agglomerate together to serve a collective destructive purpose like this? Are there animals that will form giant balls out of their bodies? And the answer is yes. The one answer I could think of on the spot when we read this first mail was the bivouac formed by colonies of army ants. I think driver ants too. The bivouac is essentially a mobile protective nest made by the ants out of their own bodies, and by ants out of ants, living ants. So the colony will form this kind of cyclopean mass made out of hundreds of thousands of worker ants that gather around the queen and her larvae to protect them when the foraging column comes to rest. And of course, they have to do this because they can't form a permanent nest structure, say like with tunnels in the ground or a mound like some other types of ants or eusocial insects, because the colony, it forages so much that it always has to keep moving to find new feeding sources. So they have to take their nest with them. So the nest is made out of the colony, out of the ants' own bodies. So the worker ants grip each other's legs to form this cohesive structure around the queen for the resting period. And then when it's time to move again, the bivouac dissolves and the ants go on their way. Now, Troy writes to us with another example of stunningly weird agglomeration behavior in animals, and it might not be a surprise that it's also from the order of Hymenoptera. So he brings up the behavior known as bee balling, or sometimes heat balling, in honeybees. This is a really interesting defensive strategy that has been documented in the Asian honeybee. I was reading about it in papers specifically on the Japanese honeybee, which is Apis serrana japonica, and it works to protect the bees' colonies against attacks by predatory hornets, such as the Asian giant hornet, Vespa mandarinia. And it seems like this is actually a pretty complex interspecies relationship. Just one example I was reading about, that there is some evidence of information exchange between bees and hornets that can sometimes avert failed predation attempts that would be costly for both parties. So maybe bees can do behaviors that let the hornets know that the bees see the hornets and thus are preparing their defenses, and thus the hornets can just avoid attacking them in the first place because it probably won't be successful and it'll just hurt both sides. But if a hornet does decide to attack a hive of Asian honeybees, the main lethal defensive strategy available to the bees is to surround the hornet in a tight cluster and then violently vibrate their flight muscles. So this tight ball of vibrating bees quickly increases in temperature. It gets hot, and the structure of the bee ball traps the heat, and it also traps carbon dioxide inside. And this combination of heat and CO2 density kills the hornet, but allows most of the bees to survive. And interestingly, though, of course, Japanese honeybees can sting, I read that they rarely use their stingers against predatory hornets. The ball is all you need. Also, I just wanted to mention, while I was reading about this, I came across a related fact concerning another defensive strategy used by Asian honeybee colonies against hornet attacks. And this was in a paper by Matilla et al., published in PLOS One in 2020. The paper is called "Honeybees, Apis serrana, Use Animal Feces as a Tool to Defend Colonies Against Group Attack by Giant Hornets, Vespa soror." And yeah, so you heard it there in the title. This paper documented Asian honeybees responding to threats from predatory hornets by foraging for animal feces, such as water buffalo dung, bringing that animal dung back to the hive and smearing it around the entrance to the hive. To read from the abstract here, quote, "Fecal spotting increased after colonies were exposed either to naturally occurring attacks or to chemicals that scout hornets use to target colonies for mass attack. Spotting continued for days after attacks ceased and occurred in response to Vespa soror, which frequently landed at and chewed on entrances to breach nests, but not Vespa velutina, a smaller hornet that rarely landed at entrances. Moderate to heavy fecal spotting suppressed attempts by V. soror to penetrate nests by lowering the incidence of multiple hornet attacks and substantially reducing the likelihood of them approaching and chewing on entrances. We argue that Apis serrana forages for animal feces because it has properties that repel this deadly predator from nest entrances, providing the first report of tool use by honeybees and the first evidence that they forage for solids that are not derived from plants." So what are these properties of animal dung that would work to keep the hornets away? The authors say they do not know yet. Also, just a note that if you dig into the paper, they do qualify the claim that this is the first documentation of tool use in honeybees, because as usual with studies about tool use in animals, there is disagreement about what the criteria are. And there have been other observations that could qualify as tool use in bees, depending on your criteria.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, this next message comes from Chuck, and it is a response to our series of episodes on the invention of the crossbow. Specifically, this is Chuck from San Diego. Chuck from San Diego says, "Dear Robert, Joe, and JJ, thanks again for your interesting, thoughtful, and informative content. I think, like many of your listeners, I don't normally have a reason in my daily life to ponder many of the topics you discuss in depth, but I'm glad you do it for me. Often your discussion reminds me to consider topics in new ways or simply unlock cherished memories. That's a long-winded way of saying you guys enrich my life. Case in point, crossbows." Oh, thank you, Chuck. That means a lot. About crossbows, Chuck says, "I personally found the discussion of crossbows as a, quote, evil weapon fascinating, considering two formative memories that I have that counter that notion. The first is from the 1980 movie Hawk the Slayer. This sword and sorcery film, a good selection for Weird House Cinema actually, stars Jack Palance as the evil Voltan and John Terry as the titular Hawk. Hawk must gather a ragtag band of heroes to defeat Voltan and restore order and goodness to the land. The film is not good, but it does have its moments, especially in some of the character and action choices. One of the heroes, played by William Morgan Shepherd, is Ranulf, who loses a hand and replaces it with a repeating crossbow, fed by a clip of bolts, with an insane rate of fire. To 8-year-old me, watching it for the first time in 1980, this was the coolest weapon ever. Of course, because of Ranulf, repeating crossbows ended up in later D&D campaigns. I guess Chuck means his own D&D campaigns. I'm not sure. Or Chuck, do you mean that this like inspired the creators of the D&D players guides to, I don't know. Yeah. Write in and clarify if you want. Chuck goes on, the second memory is from the 1983 Atari arcade light gun game, Crossbow. This cabinet had a near life-size version of a crossbow that players had to use to defend their adventuring allies as they slowly moved from left to right across hazard-filled screens. Eventually, the players had to find and shoot the Master of Darkness to win the game. As your life meter, your adventuring allies on screen were essentially useless. Think endless escort quest. So it was up to only you and your trusty crossbow to save the land from darkness. Thanks again for all you do, and my very best wishes to you and your families this holiday season. Sincerely, Chuck from San Diego. Oh, well, thank you so much, Chuck, and same back to you and yours. So I have never seen Hawk the Slayer, but I just looked up the poster before recording here, and I guess this is supposed to be John Terry as Hawk here, but it's just Han Solo. The costume is exactly the same. Folks, look this up. Hawk the Slayer. Am I wrong? There's like the deep V-neck, off-white shirt with the long sleeves, black vest, dark pants, tall boots. It's just Han Solo from the first Star Wars movie. And I looked up shots from the actual movie of Hawk the Slayer, and his costume's a little different on screen, but that poster is, come on, shameless, dudes. Also, Jack Palance as the villain has an interesting costume feature. He wears a metal helmet that only reveals one eye. The other eye gap in the helmet is covered with a steel plate. So I guess it's taking the villain with an eye patch principle to the next level. All right, next message is about Weird House Cinema. This is from Steph. Steph says, "Hello, gentlemen. I listened to your Weird House Cinema episode on The Butterfly Murders and, as always, really enjoyed it and wished I could see the movie myself. After hearing how rare a copy of this movie was, I pretty much gave up hope for ever seeing it and relegated myself to checking out the trailer on YouTube. I fired up my laptop and found the trailer easily, but as often happens, things got busy. Dinner had to be made and cleaned up, homework had to be finished, and kids needed baths and tucking in. So I left it until this morning. I sat down with my coffee to watch what I thought was about to be about a 4-minute trailer. Guys, it's the whole movie. I am absolutely stoked at this turn of events. I only wish it wasn't Monday morning before I had to leave for work. I plan on revisiting this when I get home and watching the heck out of this movie. Thanks for all you do. You keep me entertained with thought-provoking deep dives on the most bonkers in the best way subjects and wonderful so bad they're good movie recaps. I appreciate you too. Sincerely, Steph." Oh, well, thank you, Steph. Thank you for the nice comments, and I hope you enjoy the movie. I would like to once again issue a call to somebody out there who, I don't know, owns the rights to this or whatever. Put out a high-quality restoration disc of The Butterfly Murders. I am ready to give you my money. And Steph, you'll have to let us know what you think of the movie. I hope we didn't build it up too much, but hope you enjoyed as much as we did. Okay, one last message in response to our series on the legends of headless ghosts, gods, and monsters. This message comes from Taylor, and it describes a strange and uncanny personal experience. So I'll leave you with a little spooky story at the end of today's episode. Taylor says, "Hello, Rob and Joe. I just finished your 2-part series on headless beings and felt inclined to share a spooky personal anecdote in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind tradition of the Halloween hangover." Ooh, I guess we're getting a little deep in November for that, but you know what? That's all right. Taylor says, on a chilly autumn evening in my mid-teens, I was cycling home from a friend's house when I spotted a strange mass of gore and feathers on the side of the road. The amorphous thing was centered in a pool of light cast by a corner street lamp. Ever curious and unsure what I beheld, I dismounted my bike to get a closer look. As I approached in horrified fascination, the thing rose up and turned to regard me with the gory stump of its neck. I realized that the previously indistinguishable mass of bloody feathers was a decapitated chicken. For a long moment, I stared into that neck stump, and the stump seemed to stare back at me. Then, with seeming serenity, the chicken settled back into a resting position, and I went on my way. I generally have a poor memory of my personal history, but this moment was so chilling and bizarre that it is burned into my mind. I grew up in a semi-rural area, and I was aware that a chicken's body could go about without its head for some hours, but who had dispatched this chicken without collecting it? How had the body wandered into the street? Why was it sitting right beneath a lamp as if composed to frighten me? And most importantly, how did it seem to see me without a head? As an adult and a science educator, this memory serves as an example against the false horse and rider dichotomy we tend to draw between body and head. Perhaps the chicken was under the street lamp because it was a relatively warm location in its immediate environment. Perhaps it felt the vibrations of my approaching footfalls through its feet and thus rose to regard me. And perhaps all of those stimuli were parsed and processed by an avian body bereft of its head. I hope you and my fellow listeners enjoy this spooky little memory. As ever, thank you for sharing your thoughtful meditations with all of us. I hope you and yours enjoy happy holidays. Taylor. Well, thank you, Taylor. That is truly a creepy story. I don't know what the best explanation of all that would be. I know there are these stories of, famously, Mike the Headless Chicken, which after being decapitated by a farmer, went on to live for something like 18 months or something. And the explanation in that case was that the farmer had severed its head near like the base of the skull, but still most of its brain stem was intact and was able to keep regulating body function for a while. But even in other cases, I know, you know, as you say, chickens do sometimes move around for a little bit after getting their heads chopped off. But in this case, yeah, I don't know how to explain what you saw. Actually, the creepiest part for me is not really the fact that it was a chicken still sort of alive and moving around without a head, but that question you raised about how it got that way and why it was sitting there by itself, like if a human or a predator removed its head, where'd they go? I don't know. Creepy. All right, that's going to close things out for today, but Rob and I will be back tomorrow with all new stuff for you to enjoy. We read listener mail every Monday on the show. Tuesdays and Thursdays are our core Stuff to Blow Your Mind episodes about science and culture. Wednesdays, we run short-form episodes called The Artifact or The Monster Fact. On Fridays, we take a break from our regular subject matter to do a show we call Weird House Cinema, where each week we watch and discuss a weird movie. It can be great or terrible, well-known or obscure. The only real criterion is that it is weird. And then on Saturdays, we feature an older episode of the show from The Vault. Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.